And now, Icon Art Radio.
Hi, it's Bill Teeple and Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, and this is Icon Art Radio. So, Alan, you had an interesting point you were making before we went on the air.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about the last show when we were talking at the very end about these guys in a warehouse in L.A. who painted 8-foot reproductions of the hot new CD albums that had just come out for Tower Records, which is a record company that used to exist in L.A. And I guess the question I had is, you know, you see the guy in this warehouse painting an incredibly good painting of a photograph. and he's really good. I mean, he understands the medium. He's painting on big sheets of plywood, but he's painting very fast and very effectively. And when he's done, you think you're looking at an enlarged photograph. When you get up close to it, you can tell that it's a hand painting and there's no attempt to be hyper-realistic or anything. But this guy really knows what he's doing. And there's like a crew of six or eight guys and gals in there painting, you know, these small billboards. And the question that I was thinking is, okay, they're painters. Are they artists? Do they think of themselves as artists? Do we think of them as artists? Is the painting that one of these people actually produces, is that art? Or is that, quote, just, you know, a billboard? And I guess, you know, it gets us into some pretty horrible questions of what's art and who's an artist. And yet it's a wonderful, you know, kind of manifestation of something that so obviously is art, and yet it could equally obviously not be art.
Well, I'm very familiar with these billboards because I grew up in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And I always thought of them as as a job.
Yeah.
It was an artist, and this was his job.
Right.
And he's turning these things out. And I was not able to distinguish between one, that one was by one artist and one by another artist.
Right.
They all seemed to be fairly good blow-ups of the album covers.
Yeah.
At the same time, there was a gestalt, or there was a kind of like atmosphere in Tower Records where we're all sort of grooving on music, on these new albums, and each of these would be the latest, coolest thing happening.
Yeah.
So the record might be playing in there while you're looking through the albums, and it's on the wall, and there's a kind of like a universal sort of like hip experience that's going on that these are part of. Not unlike, and this is opening up a whole other show, the San Francisco music art scene in the 60s.
And the album cover.
And so we had the poster scene was going on.
Right.
And the poster scene, there was more individuality involved with the design of those posters. And so we knew at that, in the midst of that, that we were in part of a very unique scene, that I was, you know, visualizing myself in the middle of something that was like these Paris artists back when I was reading about at the time.
Yeah.
And in fact, history has shown that that was a very precious moment, and anybody was there was in the middle of something that was historical. These posters, they, so obviously the posters in my mind were an art form and an art scene. Now the billboards at Tower Records, I didn't view the same way, and yet it was part of a scene. I don't know. Somebody say something.
Well, I think there's gradations of the definition of art. There's art as fine art, you know, the highest fine art, the things that are chosen to be put in the Museum of Modern Art in New York or something like that. And then there's art as life, the art of life, you know, that you're making a beautiful table setting or something like that, or making a poster. Or as writers, there are a lot of writers who, for their day job, they write advertising copy. And somebody, you know, the guy who created the J. Peterman catalog, when that was out, took that to a highly entertaining, very creative level, such that, to me, that was good writing. It was
exciting. Sure, they were haikus almost.
Yeah, to get those things. So, and then there are writers who write scripts for silly sitcoms on television, but every once in a while you'll hit a line and you'll just go, whoa, that is a great line. And probably it's the same thing with the, I don't remember seeing these billboards. I probably did. I lived in LA at one time. But I would guess that there probably are some people whose work would strike you more. You go by and it's like, whoa, that's an amazing one. Somehow that brushstrokes brought out more than the original photograph of that album cover had, you know, that, so.
Well, the reason that it intrigued me is because I had been earning a living largely as a software architect and software designer and developer. And I thought of software, I mean, I had been doing that since the very first generation of microprocessors and things. And I had always thought of that as a tremendously creative area. And inadvertently, I ended up running the information systems and information management departments of an aerospace company for 7 years. And this was a very unimaginative environment. They had an R&D lab, but even the R&D lab was pretty well stultified by procedures and you know, regulations and the general company mentality, which was brutally uncreative. But there I was, you know, and I was hiring programmers to do stuff that we needed to have done. And it was in a business context, but it required a lot of insight and a lot of subtlety and a lot of ingenuity and a lot of genuine creativity. And I was talking to one of these creative programmers, I'll say, for want of a better term, and one of my other programmers was kind of lingering in the hall outside my door, and when we got done with the conversation, he came in and he said, you know, I just wanted to ask you a question. I couldn't help overhearing some of that. And he said, what on earth are you talking about when you say programming is creative? Well, this was a guy who had been a programmer for probably 20 years, and I inherited him when I got this department to run. And I was just startled. It had never crossed my mind that programming wasn't, that software development wasn't creative. And his role was to design financial reports for the accounting department. And he wrote these reports in COBOL, which is it stands for Common Business Oriented Language. And it was invented specifically to make an IBM 360 pump out reports that accounting people would like. Now, an artist could easily, I mean, a sort of stereotypical artist could easily say, okay, you just defined something that's more boring than I could possibly tolerate in 8 different ways. But still, there is creativity in interpreting and understanding what the accounting people need and what the data available can reflect and how to present that visually to them in a useful way. This guy just, he didn't see it. He had no idea what I was talking about, and he was kind of startled to think that anyone would use the word creativity or creative and programming in the same sentence. And I was in the exact opposite position. I was startled that someone would think that they wouldn't belong in the same sentence pretty much all the time.
So do you think it's a lifestyle thing, either one of you, that there are people who are just, who operate as creative individuals, no matter what they do, and other people who just plain
don't think that way.
This guy may be being creative and not noticing.
Exactly. Himself yeah. that way.
And so it's a spectrum. He's not being consciously creative. He's a human, so I think he inevitably is being creative in some aspects of what he's doing. And just in adapting to office politics, you know, maybe is where a large portion of his creativity is going. But it really does raise the question. And you know, everything is in shades of gray. And so you can't say that some people just aren't creative, but you can certainly suggest that some people see that creativity per se has a role in what they're doing, and other people see problem solving, the kinds of problem solving that are part and parcel of creativity, as being a nuisance, being things that, you know, obstacles to be overcome. And that's, of course, personality. It's just individuality.
They're definitely sort of like two sides here, almost like man and woman. You know, I mean, there's people. Well, nowhere to go with this.
Well, I have.
Go ahead. Let take off.
Because
I was thinking. I mean, since you were talking, we'll keep with the man and woman theme. Although this is like a dangerous thing to say.
Let's try not to go there.
Because I was going to talk about cooking, which is certainly not a female. You know, there's probably more male chefs than there are female chefs, maybe not anymore, but for a long time there were. But
we could even say almost like conservative and more liberal, meaning.
We'll skip the hot point divisions. Right.
But
anyway.
I mean, you know, the state, people who, yeah, let's forget that and
we'll
keep
forget
going.
That the point was that with regards to cooking, there definitely are people who are a bit more daringly creative when they're preparing food. Mm-hmm. They don't tend to use recipe books, or if they do, they don't follow them. They just kind of use them as catalyst and do their own thing. There are people who prepare a meal thinking about color and the presentation, what's going to look like on the plate, and even what color plate to put it on. And there are other people who think of food as primarily necessary fuel. Yeah. For the body, or what they're thinking about consciously when they're making a meal is the nutritional content. You know, do I have enough protein, and what are the vitamins, you know, that are going to be in this meal and all of that. And then there are people who really don't even like to think about it, but they have to eat, so they buy prepared food from the grocery store and just warm it up.
Yeah.
Or people who follow a recipe and, you know, absolutely fanatically, like a mathematical formula. In all of those methods, what's creative and what isn't? Or is it just like gradations? Or they're all creating something.
Yeah,
all of these people are creating a meal.
Yeah, I think evolution and change cannot be avoided.
Yeah.
But there are those who try to, and that might be one side. That's the conservative sort of like status quo side. And then there's those who want to rush headlong off the cliff. Mm-hmm. And that some balance has to be achieved for us as a whole to progress without blowing ourselves up. But I love this discussion of the nature of creativity and the nature of activity.
And while you're doing it is part of it too. It's like if you have a job and you have to please a client or your boss or something like that, you may decide, you know, like my son Dane, he works as a picture framer for a framing shop in Chicago. Now, he's a very creative guy. Maybe somebody brings in a work of art or a photograph or something, and he himself would think, oh, man, I know a really cool way to frame this. But he has to follow the person's taste and, you know, frame it the way they want it framed. He can't really use his own creativity the way he would if he's framing his own artwork. I think we have situations where we can just be completely in the let her rip zone and break all the boundaries we want to break and do whatever we feel like doing. And and others, where in a way our creativity might be a little bit more stimulated because we have boundaries,
well,
but
exactly.
We want to be creative within the boundaries.
A lot of people go off the deep end. A lot of people not that feel like they can express themselves totally freely now have no boundaries and no structure, and they just, it doesn't hang together.
Well, maybe the definition, clearly you can't really define art, but at least I think that's clear. And we could talk about that for a couple of months. But maybe you can, in a sense, have kind of a working definition of artist, in that an artist is someone who puts a conscious emphasis on being creative. Whether they're able to do it full time or not is another issue. But they have some sort of conscious priority to take a creative route. And again, it doesn't mean they're thinking about creativity, but that the result is in their lives that they, instead of just trying to learn how to do it the right way and then stop thinking about it, their inclination is to try and find interesting ways of doing it and maybe not do it the same way forever, which would make them, you know, bad candidates for assembly line work. But, you know, it's always, I think, been a question whether humans in general are good candidates for assembly line work. That might be why we pay auto workers so very much to do what they do. And, you know, of course, also why, you know, we don't manufacture stuff in the United States very much anymore, because, you know, in some ways this is a very, or has been, a very highly creative, you know, nation. And by definition, then, creative people are not going to be all that comfortable with unchanging routine work. And it's been great to be able to use automation to solve that problem, even though you have to pay the price of, you know, having fewer jobs to do, but maybe in a lot of cases they are jobs that really nobody should have been doing. In the early days of the Industrial Revolution, you know, we had children, you know, running around giant loom machines, you know, weaving machines, changing the bobbins and things like that, and occasionally getting crushed to death. And it was just, you know, they were just part of the machine. And since the 50s, I guess, when, you know, industrialization became so obviously part of our culture, artists and commentators and revolutionaries and thinkers and scholars and so on have been saying, you know, people shouldn't be just a cog in a machine. In fact, I can think of the lyrics to several popular songs in that vein.
I don't know if I should mention Rudolf Steiner was a thinker of the early part of the 20th century and an experiencer. He had certain experiences. He spoke, and one reason I talk about Steiner is he's one person who wrote about art and various other aspects of life, because he believed in bringing kind of these kind of cognitions that people like him had into a context that had value to society. So he applied his cognitions to this effect on science, or economics and education and the arts and all these different things. He talked about two forces in constant opposition, the Ahrimanic force and the Luciferic force. And in this case, Luciferic had to do more with light than it did with the devil and all of that that people might bring to that concept. And he said that there were the Ahrimanic force was the force that wanted everything to become machine-like. And the force that was in opposition to it was the force towards ecstasy. And then and so these were constantly, I mean, the reason this came to mind is that as we're describing this thing going on in creativity and the this sort of a fluctuation going on in each artist, each individual, and in society, it made me think of this. But he talked about a third force that he called the Christic force, which was the force that balanced the other two. And so there's
Well, it's interesting
insight.
That then he... his thinking gave rise to the Waldorf schools that incorporate learning with art in a very integrated way.
Yeah.
And I don't know how the timing of Steiner related to this other guy, but there's this guy, Froebel, who was actually the person who invented kindergarten. And he had this whole system, I think he called them the 12 gifts. And they were very beautiful materials that he developed to teach kindergarten-age children principles of nature and ways of thinking that were going to be useful to their lives. And Frank Lloyd Wright's mother discovered when she was traveling in Europe this guy, Froebel, and she brought the set of Froebel blocks and materials and everything back to her little boy, little Frank Lloyd. And he, as an adult, actually credited being raised that way through the Froebel system of learning in kindergarten to his choice to become an architect and his approach to architecture, because it integrated nature with structure, with beauty, with a progression of creativity and all that that gets more complex as you move through these 12 gifts.
Yeah, that's interesting. I sometimes wonder if my response to repetitive activity is based on creativity or on laziness. Because if I find myself doing the same thing for the third time, I'm just automatically thinking of how I can automate it, how I can, you
know, get out of that.
Find a better way of doing it that won't require doing it over and over again.
The way that I express that in my own life is I'm really good at creativity and I'm really good at destruction, like just like giving up something and letting go, but I'm not very good at maintenance.
Yes.
So I don't like doing things like vacuuming the floor, you know, where you have to do it over and over again. There's not much of a difference, you know, but you know that you have to do it. Brushing my teeth, things like that. It's just like, oh, shoot, I have to do these things just to maintain.
No, I know what you're saying.
Well, I think we have an over balance in this in the direction of the luciferic.
In this room,
I'm afraid so. And in culture since the mid-20th century, or even the beginning of the 20th century.
I keep thinking of my wife, Mary, who was immune to that whole aspect of routine and sort of, you know, nuisance factor activity. I mean, she was completely immune to it.
Immune meaning
she
what?
Was unable to experience any negative component in any sense in any kind of activity. She would do whatever needed to be done. For her, the thing that motivated her to do something was the reaction that it would get from other people. So if it was cooking Thanksgiving dinner or cooking Christmas dinner, you know, she just threw herself into it. She made a phenomenal mess. There was, you know, sugar and flour flying in all directions all throughout the kitchen. Every surface was covered with spills and slop and stuff, and it looked like a hurricane was passing through, except that by the time she was done getting everything into the ovens and that kind of stuff, the kitchen was spotless and looked like no one had even been there for the last few days. And I can remember one Christmas when, having done that once for about 10 people for dinner, and by the time we were, you know, pushing ourselves away from the table, the kitchen and most of the dining room looked like they had never been used. And you didn't get the feeling Mary was like doing anything. She was just, you know, cheerfully carrying on the conversation with everybody and coming and going a little bit, and everything was disappearing. And we got a phone call from some friends who had just come into the area, and she said, ask them to come over and have dinner with us, you know. So I did, thinking, well, we just finished eating all the food, you know. Mary went out, bought another turkey, bought another whole selection of stuff, and prepared another Christmas dinner for 10 more people. And by the time they were seated at the dinner table, the kitchen looked like it had never been used.
And was she still relaxed?
She was completely relaxed. She was just having fun.
It's amazing.
So I would call this art.
Yeah, I think you have to.
Now, if she was just a drudge and just complaining the whole time, that I got to do this again, this is the 50th year that I've done this, and I hated it.
I mean, I don't think people who knew her ever could cite an example of her complaining about
something. What was getting generated here? There was some, it was delight.
Yeah, it was delight. She was serving all of these friends. She was giving them something.
So, I mean, so the ecstasy was getting generated, it seems to me.
Yeah, definitely.
So here we're talking, and we know that your wife was a very integrated person.
Yeah.
That this integration is really quite apparent in this description of the balance, the routine work, and the generation of ecstasy all at once.
Yeah. Because if I do something I like, and get some ecstatic satisfaction from doing it, if it also makes a mess in the process, that mess is not ecstatic. I don't want to clean that mess up. I'd rather just move to another room and have another ecstatic experience, create another mess.
But it also touches on the point that we made before about communication and feedback with any creative process, because you said what seemed like what gave her this ecstasy is she was giving this gift. All this activity is giving this gift to people. The people were happy. The people were not like she was doing it to get their praise, but just to make them happy.
She was really enjoying
it was like this
happiness.
Cycle of energy that was generating through her, by her, you know.
Well, so, and you brought this up in our last show. There's an experience in collective consciousness that's getting generated in the art process, and it's this totality of life being acknowledged and lived in delight together.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
That seems to be driving this thing.
And maybe this gives us a whole new angle on considering what art is and what an artist is and what creativity is how much of the process, whatever it is, or the person or the intent, is connected to giving, to service, to devotion, to love. And so we have our Christmas show.
Listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.